designed to stir the right expectation or insight. They don't need to be sentences. They can be captions, signposts, words or phrases used to guide readers through the content of your essay, poetry. And they can be bracketed by silence. Yes, silence. When you have something incredible to show, the best way of drawing attention to it is to set it up, show it, and shut up. As I mentioned previously, kinetic sculptor Ruben Margolin knows how to do this. During one 30-second period of his talk, come live exhibition, here is all he had to say. A single drop of rain, increasing amplitude. Those words were surrounded by silence, but the screen was alive with the hypnotic movement of his sculpture, and the audience was lost in awe at the beauty he had created. Photographer Franz Lanting created an entire performance around his photographs to illustrate the evolution of life on Earth. As the stunning photographs advanced, a Philip Glass soundtrack played, and Franz softly intoned life's story. With all the tools available today in a modern theatre, lighting, surround sound, high-res projection, it's something of a tragedy that the world's best visual artists often don't make use of them. Instead of thinking about how to immerse an audience in their work, they assume that since they were invited to give a talk, that's what they have to do. My hope for the future? More show, less tell. 14. Surprise appearances. After an extraordinary story is told about someone, there may be additional impact in bringing that person onto the stage live. At TED 2014, MIT professor Hugh Herr described how he had built a new bionic leg for Adrian Hazlett-Davis, a ballroom dancer who had been injured in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Then he stunned the audience by introducing Adrian live to give her first public dance performance on her new leg. And at TEDx Rio de la Plata, Christina Domenech's talk about poetry in prisons was energized by a live reading from inmate Martin Bustamante, who had been permitted a temporary release to attend. This approach works best when there is a real contribution made by the special guest. If that can't happen, it's better simply to acknowledge his or her presence in the audience. To pull someone on stage for just a brief hello can feel awkward. 15. Virtual presenters. Technology is allowing new ways to bring a speaker to the stage. In June of 2015, success coach Tony Robbins appeared at a business conference in Melbourne, Australia. Except he didn't want to actually travel all the way to Australia. So instead, he appeared via 3D hologram. Organizers claim his avatar had as much impact as the man himself. When we invited whistleblower Edward Snowden to TED in 2014, there was just one problem. He was living in exile in Moscow and couldn't travel to Vancouver for fear of being arrested. But we wired him in nonetheless in the form of a telepresence robot called BeamPro. If anything, it added to the drama. During the breaks, the Snowden bot roamed the hallway, allowing attendees to chat with him and snap photos, creating a Twitter trend, hashtag selfies with Snowden. Of course, both these uses benefited from their relative novelty, but the technology is continually improving. One of the surprises of TED's success has been that a speaker on video has almost as much impact as a speaker in the room. So there's no reason a hologram or telepresence bot can't have full impact. The possibilities here are limitless. For example, when composer Eric Whitaker unveiled a piece of music at TED in 2013, it was performed not just by a choir on the stage. They were joined by musicians from 30 different countries, singing together live, courtesy of a special tech hookup engineered for us by Skype. As they appeared on screen, united in song, it seemed for a moment that the differences that tear our world apart could be bridged by elements as simple as an internet connection, music from the heart, and people willing to reach out. I glanced around at the audience and saw many a cheek wet with tears. I think we can expect to see a lot more experiments like this going forward. innovations that will allow gatherings of people that simply wouldn't have been possible any other way. Indeed, there may well soon be a day when real robots walk on stage and give talks, talks that they have helped to write. We're working on it. 16. No live audience. The ultimate talk innovation may be not to play with what happens on stage, but just to take away the stage altogether. Also, the theatre, the live audience, and the host. After all, we're in a connected world now. Thanks to the internet, we can communicate to countless thousands of people live or via video. That global audience can dwarf any group that can come together physically in a room. So why not just design a talk directly for that audience? Swedish statistician Hans Rosling has done a series of incredible TED Talks, notching up collectively more than 20 million views. But one of his most popular talks wasn't done on a stage at all. It was filmed by the BBC in an empty warehouse, and Rosling's trademark graphics were added in post-production. In a world where everyone has access to video cameras and editing tools, there will be an unstoppable trend of significant talks delivered directly to the internet. Our Open TED initiative, described at the end of chapter 20, seeks to tap into this trend. This won't replace the power of people coming together physically. There are far too many benefits from the ancient experience of real in-the-moment human contact. But direct-to-video talks will be a wonderful playground for rapid experimentation, innovation, and learning. I am incredibly excited about the ways in which public speaking may evolve over the coming years. But I do also think it's worth sounding a note of caution. Many of the innovations mentioned above are potentially powerful, but they shouldn't be overused. The basic technology of human-to-human speaking goes back hundreds of thousands of years and is very deeply wired into us. In seeking modern variants, we must be careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Human attention is a fragile thing. If you add too many extra ingredients, the main thrust of a talk may get lost. So let's embrace a spirit of innovation. There are wonderful opportunities out there to advance the great art of public speaking. But let's also never forget that substance matters more than style. Ultimately, it's all about the idea. Reflection. 19. Talk Renaissance, the interconnectedness of knowledge. I wish to persuade you of something. That however much public speaking skills matter today, they're going to matter even more in the future. Driven by our growing connectedness, one of humankind's most ancient abilities is being reinvented for the modern era. I've become convinced that tomorrow, even more than today, learning to present your ideas live to other humans will prove to be an absolutely essential skill for any child who wants to build confidence, anyone leaving school and looking to start a meaningful career, anyone who wants to progress at work, anyone who cares about an issue, anyone who wants to build a reputation, anyone who wants to connect with others around the world who share a passion, anyone who wants to catalyze action to make an impact, anyone who wants to leave a legacy, anyone, period. The best way I can make this argument is to share with you my own learning journey of the past couple of decades, a period that completely changed my understanding of why great public speaking matters and what it might become. So let me take you back to Wednesday, February 18th, 1998, Monterey, California, which is when and where I first set foot inside a TED conference. Back then, I thought of conferences as necessary evils. You put up with hours of tedious panels and presentations in order to meet the people from your industry that you need to meet. However, my good friend, Sunny Bates, one of the world's great connectors, persuaded me that TED was different and I should check it out. I ended the first day a little bemused. I had heard a series of short talks from a software programmer, a marine biologist, an architect, a tech entrepreneur, and a graphic designer. They were nicely done, but I was struggling to find their relevance to me. I was a media guy. I published magazines. How was this going to help me do my work better? When TED was founded back in 1984, Richard, Ricky, Werman, and his co-founder, Harry Marks, had a theory that there was growing convergence between the technology, entertainment, and design industries, the T, E, and D of TED. It made sense. That was the year the first Apple Macintosh computer was launched, the year that Sony unveiled the first compact discs. Both products had deep roots in all three industries. It was exciting to imagine what other possibilities would emerge if you connected the three fields together. Maybe technologists could make their products more appealing by listening to the ideas of human-centered designers and creative entertainers. Maybe architects, designers, and entertainment industry leaders could expand their sense of possibility by understanding new developments in technology. And so it proved. After a wobbly start and a personality clash between the founders, which persuaded Harry to sell his 50% stake to Ricky for a dollar, TED took off in the 1990s, accompanied by the rise of CD-ROM-fueled multimedia, Wired magazine, and the early internet. In his earlier life, Ricky had coined the term information architecture and had become obsessed with making obscure knowledge accessible. This skill helped him drive speakers to find the most interesting angle on their idea, the angle that others outside their fields might enjoy or find relevant. And he had another personality trait that would obliquely prove core to TED's success. Impatience. Ricky easily became bored by long talks. As TED developed, he began giving speakers shorter and shorter time slots, and he simply walked on stage and cut people off if they went on too long. He also banned audience questions on the grounds that it would be more interesting to cram in another speaker than hear some audience member promote his own business under the guise of asking a question. This may have been really annoying to a few individuals, but for the audience experience overall, it was a godsend. It made for a fast-moving program. You could put up with the occasional dud talk because you knew it would be over soon. On my second day at TED, I began to truly appreciate the short talk format. Even though I wasn't yet certain of the relevance to me and my work, I was certainly being exposed to a lot of topics. Video games for girls, the design of chairs, a new way of exploring information in 3D, a solar-powered airplane. They all followed each other in a rush. There was an acceleration in learning how many different types of expertise there were in the world. And something was starting to spark. A comment made by a speaker in one field would somehow resonate with something someone in a completely different field had said the day before. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I was starting to get excited. Most conferences serve a single industry or knowledge speciality. There, everyone has a common language and starting point, and it makes sense to allow speakers time to go really deep and describe some specific new learning. But when the content and audience are wide-ranging, a speaker's goal isn't to exhaustively cover a niche topic. Instead, it's to make her work accessible to others, to show why it's interesting, to show why it matters. That can usually be done in less than 20 minutes. And that's good, because for someone outside your field, that's probably all the time they'll give you. As listeners, we may be willing to invest 45 minutes or an hour on a university subject we have to learn or on someone who works directly in our field. But to give someone outside our normal work life that kind of time? Not possible. There aren't enough hours in the day. On day three, something really strange happened. My overstimulated brain began sparking like a lightning storm. Every time a new speaker got up and spoke, it felt like a new thunderbolt of wisdom. Ideas from one talk would connect in a thrilling way with something shared by others 2 days earlier. And then came Amy Mullins. Amy had had both her legs amputated at age one, but that hadn't stopped her from leading a full life. She sat on stage and spoke of how, 3 years earlier as a college freshman, she had run her first race as a sprinter, and how, aided by a pair of beautifully designed sprinter's legs, she had rocketed through trials for the US Paralympics team. And then she casually removed her prosthetics and showed how she could replace them easily with other legs for other situations. As Amy spoke about her surprising successes and embarrassing failures, I sat at the back of the theatre, shocked at the tears running down my cheeks. She was so alive and so full of possibility. She seemed to symbolise something I'd sensed time and again that week, that it was possible to own your future. No matter what life had served you, you could find a way to shape it, and in so doing, make a difference for others too. By the time I had to leave the conference, I understood why it meant so much to people there. I was thrilled by all I'd learned. I felt a greater sense of possibility than I had experienced in a long time. I felt like I'd come home. 2 years later, when I heard that Ricky Wurman was looking to sell the conference, I became tantalized at the thought of taking it over. For my entire entrepreneurial life, my mantra had been to follow the passion. Not my passion, other people's. If I saw something that people were truly, deeply passionate about, that was the big clue that there was opportunity there. Passion was a proxy for potential. That was how I justified launching dozens of hobbyist magazines covering everything from computing to mountain biking to cross-stitching. Those topics might be deeply boring to most people, but to those the magazines were targeted at, they were passion-driven gold. The passion I'd seen and experienced at TED was off the charts. People who had done amazing things with their lives had told me this was their favorite week of the year. So even though it was only a small annual conference, there was every possibility that something more could be built out of that passion. On the other hand, it was a new business to get involved with, and I would be following in the shoes of a man with a much bigger, brasher personality than mine. What if I failed? The public humiliation would be pretty intense. I consulted friends, lay awake at night trying to imagine every possibility, but couldn't get to a decision. What finally convinced me to go for it was, believe it or not, a passage in a book I happened to be reading at the time, namely David Deutsch's The Fabric of Reality. In it, he asked a provocative question. Is it really true that knowledge has to become ever more specialized? That the only way we can achieve success is by knowing more and more about less and less? The specialization of every field, medicine, science, art, seemed to suggest this. But Deutsch argued convincingly that we must distinguish knowledge from understanding. Yes, knowledge of specific facts inevitably became specialized. But understanding? No, not at all. To understand something, he said, we had to move in the opposite direction. We had to pursue the unification of knowledge. He gave lots of examples in which older scientific theories were replaced by deeper, broader theories that tied together more than one area of knowledge. For example, an elegant worldview based on the sun sitting at the center of the solar system replaced massively complex explanations of the whirling motions of individual planets around Earth. But more importantly still, Deutsch argued the key to understanding anything was to understand the context in which it sat. If you imagine a vast spider web of knowledge, you can't really understand the intricate knots in any small part of that web without pulling the camera back to see how the strands connect more broadly. It's only by looking at that larger pattern that you can gain actual understanding. I read this when I was dreaming about TED, and a light bulb flashed on. Of course, that was it. That was why the TED experience felt so thrilling. It was because the conference itself was reflecting the reality that all knowledge is connected into a giant web. TED truly did have something for everyone. We might not necessarily have realized it at the time, but by thinking about such eclectic ideas, we were all gaining understanding at a much deeper level than we had before. In fact, the individual ideas mattered less than how they all fit together, and what happened when we added them to our existing ideas. So actually, what made TED work was not really just the synergy between technology, entertainment, and design. It was actually the connectedness of all knowledge. Framed that way, TED was an event that would never run out of things to talk about. I mean, how many venues were there where you could explore that connectedness and explore it in a way that any curious person could find accessible and inspiring? I couldn't think of any. I hopped on a plane to visit Ricky and his wife Gloria at their home in Newport, Rhode Island. And, to cut a long and complicated story short, by the end of 2001, I had left the company I'd spent 15 years building to become the proud, albeit slightly nervous, curator of TED. In the years since then, I've become ever more convinced of the significance of the connectedness of knowledge, and I have encouraged TED to expand from the original TED to pretty much every field of human creativity and ingenuity. I don't see this framing of knowledge and understanding as just a recipe for a more interesting conference. I see it as the key to us surviving and thriving in the brave new world that's coming. Here's how I'd make the case. Many of our assumptions about the value and purpose of knowledge and how to acquire it, including the structure of our entire education system, are leftovers from the industrial age. In that era, the key to success was for a company or country to develop massive expertise in production of physical goods. This required deep specialist knowledge. The geology required to locate and extract coal and oil. The mechanical engineering needed to build and operate industrial-scale machinery. The chemistry needed to efficiently produce a massive array of materials, and so forth. The knowledge economy requires something different. Increasingly, the specialist knowledge traditionally wielded by humans is being taken over by computers. Oil is not located by human geologists, but by computer software, churning through vast amounts of geological data, looking for patterns. Today's best civil engineers no longer need to hand calculate the stresses and strains on a new building. The computer model will do that. Almost no profession is untouched. I watched an IBM Watson demo seeking to diagnose a patient with 6 specific symptoms. While doctors scratched their heads and ordered a range of tests to get more data, Watson, in just a few seconds, read through 4,000 recent relevant research papers, applied probability algorithms to each symptom, and concluded with 80% certainty that the patient had a rare condition only one of the human doctors had even heard of. At this point, people start getting depressed. They begin asking questions like, in a world in which machines are rapidly getting super smart at any specialist knowledge task we can throw at them, what are humans even for? It's an important question, and the answer to it is actually quite thrilling. What are humans for? Humans are for being more human than we've ever been. More human in how we work, more human in what we learn, and more human in how we share that knowledge with each other. Our giant opportunity for tomorrow is to rise. To rise above our long history of using specialist knowledge to do repetitive tasks, whether it's the back-breaking work of harvesting rice year after year, or the mind-numbing work of assembling a product on a manufacturing line, most humans for most of history have made a living doing the same thing over and over again. Our future won't be like that. Anything that can be automated or calculated ultimately will be. Now, we can be fearful of that, or we can embrace it and take the chance to discover a richer path to life fulfillment. What will that path look like? No one knows for sure, but it's probably going to include more system-level strategic thinking. The machines will do the grunt work, but we'll need to figure out how best to set them up to work effectively with each other. More innovation. With the massive capabilities of a connected world available to us, there's huge advantage for those who can genuinely innovate. More creativity. Robots will make a lot of our stuff, allowing for an explosion in demand for genuine human creativity, whether in tech invention, design, music, or art. More utilization of uniquely human values. Human-to-human services will flourish, provided the humanity inherent in them is cultivated. It may be possible to develop a robotic barber, but will the service alone be enough to replace the chatty interaction with a great human hairstylist come therapist? I doubt it. The doctor of the future may be able to ask for Watson's brilliance in diagnostic assistance, but that should allow more time for that doctor to really understand the human circumstances of her patient. And if any of that proves to be true, it's likely to require a very different type of knowledge than the industrial age asked of us. Imagine a world where any piece of specialist knowledge is available to you instantly on demand. If you have a smartphone, that's pretty much the world you're already living in. And if it isn't today, for your kids, it will be. So what should we and they be learning for the future? Instead of ever greater amounts of ever more specialized knowledge, we're going to need contextual knowledge, creative knowledge, and a deeper understanding of our own humanity. Contextual knowledge means knowing the bigger picture, knowing the way all the pieces fit together. Creative knowledge is the skill set obtained by exposure to a wide variety of other creative humans. A deeper understanding of our own humanity comes not from listening to your parents or your friends, nor to psychologists, neuroscientists, historians, evolutionary biologists, anthropologists, or spiritual teachers. It comes from listening to all of them. These types of knowledge aren't the domain of just a few professors in a few great universities. They aren't what you discover in a dominant company's apprenticeship program. This is knowledge that can only be assembled from a massive variety of sources. And that fact, right there, is one of the main engines powering the Renaissance in public speaking. We're entering an era where we all need to spend a lot more time learning from each other. And that means far more people than ever before can contribute to this collective learning process. Anyone who has a unique piece of work or a unique insight can productively participate. And that includes you. But how? Whether you're a brilliant astrophysicist, a talented stonemason, or just a wise student of life, I don't need to learn from you everything you know. Of course not. That would take years. What I need to know is how your work connects to everything else. Can you explain the essence of it in a way I can understand? Can you share your work process in layman's terms? Can you explain why it matters and why you are passionate about it? If you can do this, you will expand my worldview. And you may do something else. You may spark new creativity or inspiration in me. Every field of knowledge is different, but they are all connected and they often rhyme. This means that something in the way you describe your process may give me a crucial insight or catalyze a new thought in me. This is how ideas form when we spark off each other. So the first great driver of the public speaking renaissance is that the knowledge era we are entering demands a different type of knowledge, encouraging people to be inspired by those outside their traditional specialties, and in so doing to develop a deeper understanding of the world and their role in it. But that's not all. 20. Why this matters. The interconnectedness of people. The second great driver of the Renaissance in public speaking is the epic technological shift that has given us all visibility to each other. The internet, and in particular, the rise of online video. Let me tell you the story as we experienced it, because in less than a year, online video flipped TED on its head and helped us become one of the pioneers of a new way of sharing knowledge. A key catalyst for us was that TED is a non-profit. We don't often think of non-profits as robust vehicles for innovation, but in this case, that status really helped. Let me explain. When I was still working in magazines, I began to put money into a not-for-profit foundation in order to start giving back. It was that foundation that acquired TED. I worked for it without drawing a salary. To me, removing the profit motive from the table sent a clear signal of intent. It made it much easier to credibly say to the world, come and help us build a new approach to discovering and sharing ideas. After all, we ask attendees to pay a lot of money to come to our main conferences, and we ask speakers to come without being paid. It's much easier to do that if people can see that they're contributing to the public good, as opposed to someone's personal bank balance. How should TED best contribute to the public good? The small group of us running TED in the years after the transition pondered this question a lot. After all, TED was just a private conference. Yes, people were inspired there, but it was hard to see how you could scale that experience. Our early attempts to advance TED's non-profit mission were to try a fellows program, to bring to the event people who couldn't afford to pay, to have a bigger focus on global issues, and to seek to turn inspiration into action with the introduction of the TED Prize, which granted its winners a wish to better the world that other attendees would support. But at some point it felt like we had to find a way to share the content of TED. The ideas and insights being expressed deserved a broader audience. In early 2005, I found the perfect person to crack this problem. June Cohen had had an inside view of many of the key developments of the web. She was a key executive in the team that developed the pioneering Hotwired website, which had the world's first online ads, and she had written a terrific book on what it took to create a successful website. Also, she'd begun coming to TED the same year I had. She'd fallen in love with it, as I had, and every conversation between us had been provocative and valuable. June joined our fledgling team and embarked on what seemed the logical strategy for sharing TED content more widely. Get it on TV. Every TED conference ever held had been captured on video, and with all those cable channels out there, surely someone would be excited about airing a weekly show. We created a pilot, and June hawked it passionately to anyone who would listen. The resounding verdict from TV Land? Meh. Talking heads make for boring TV. We heard that time and again. We tried suggesting that just possibly that boredom thing might not be about talking heads per se, but about talking heads saying boring things. We didn't get anywhere. But meanwhile, something profound was happening to the world's infrastructure. Excited by the explosive growth of the internet, telecom companies had decided to invest billions of dollars into fiber optics and offer bandwidth upgrades. That enabled the liftoff of a technology that had at first seemed entirely innocuous, online video. During 2005, it morphed from a flickering novelty in the corner of a screen to something you could actually watch. A quirky little website called YouTube was launched, featuring short, user-generated videos, many of them starring kittens. Despite the amateurish look, it took off like a rocket. In November 2005, June came to me with a radical suggestion. Let's deprioritize TV for now and try distributing TED Talk videos online instead. On the face of it, that was a crazy idea. Quite apart from the still barely acceptable quality of online video, there was no proven revenue model for it. Could it really make sense to risk giving away our content? Wasn't that the only reason people paid so much to come to the conferences in the first place? On the other hand, it would be a major step in advancing TED's non-profit mission of sharing ideas for public benefit. And the thought of controlling our own distribution without dependency on TV networks was exciting. It was worth an experiment, at least. Thus it was that on June 22nd, 2006, the first six TED Talks debuted on our website. At the time, TED.com was getting about 1,000 visitors a day, most of them just checking details about past and future conferences. We dreamed that the release of these talks might kick that number up fivefold, yielding maybe 2 million talk views over a year, a massive boost in our overall reach. The first day, we had about 10,000 talk views. I assumed that, as usual with new media, after initial interest waned, the numbers would fall off quickly. The opposite happened. Within just 3 months, we'd reached 1 million views, and the numbers just continued to climb. Even more exciting was the tone of responses we were seeing. We had doubted the talks could have anything like the same impact online as they did live. After all, how could you hold someone's attention just peering at a small viewing window on a screen when there were so many other distractions online? The responses shocked and delighted us in their intensity. Wow! Chills shooting down my spine. Cool and inspiring. The best presentation of a complex graphic I have ever seen. Tears running down my face. Suddenly, it felt like the passion people experienced at the conference had been set free. And that could mean only one thing. The experiment we'd undergone releasing just a handful of TED Talks would have to be extended across all our best content. In March of 2007, we relaunched our website with 100 talks available. And ever since then, TED has been not so much an annual conference as a media organization devoted to ideas worth spreading. Oh, and that worry about us endangering the conference by giving away its content? Actually, the effect was the opposite. Our attendees were thrilled they could now share great talks with their friends and colleagues. And as word of TED Talks spread, the demand to attend the conferences actually rose. 8 years later, interest in TED Talks has mushroomed globally. To our surprise and delight, it has become a global platform for identifying and spreading ideas, thanks to the efforts of hundreds of speakers, thousands of volunteers, translators, and tens of thousands of local event organizers. As of late 2015, TED Talks are viewed some 100 million times every month, 1.2 billion times a year. It's not just TED, of course. Many other organizations also disseminate ideas in video format. Interest in online education generally has exploded. Khan Academy, MIT, Stanford University, and countless others have made available incredible resources for free to anyone in the world. When you step back and ponder the implications, it's pretty thrilling. Consider it first from a speaker's point of view. Over history, many of the people most passionate about an idea have spent years crisscrossing a country or a continent trying to drum up audience interest. Realistically, the most successful anyone could hope to be at this would be to speak perhaps 100 times a year in front of audiences of, on average, perhaps 500 people. So you might just about be able to reach 50,000 people in a year, and that would require a grueling schedule and an amazing advanced publicity machine. Similarly, most authors selling a book about a serious idea would consider it a huge success if they sold 50,000 copies. Yet, online, you can reach that many people in just your first day. And more than 1,000 speakers have gone on to reach an audience greater than 1 million people for a single talk. This represents a transformative leap in influence, and many speakers have attested to the impact it has made on their work. But from a viewer's point of view, the implication is even more thrilling. Almost every human born at almost every place and moment in history has had their potential capped by a single fact over which they had almost no control, namely the quality of the teachers and mentors they had access to. If a boy with Albert Einstein's brain had been born in Germany in the Dark Ages, there would have been no scientific revolution emanating from him. If a girl with Marie Curie's mind had been born in a remote Indian village 20 years ago, today she'd probably be harvesting rice and struggling to raise her children. But now, for the first time in history, it's possible for anyone on the planet who has access to the internet to summon to their home the world's greatest teachers and inspirers. The potential that represents is breathtaking. And we should not think of this as a one-way process, speaker to listener. The most profound implication of online video is that it has created an interactive ecosystem in which we can all learn from each other. In fact, you might be surprised by the group of people I learned that idea from. Mad Chad, Jay Smooth, Kid David, and Lil C are star members of the Legion of Extraordinary Dancers, the LXD. Their performance at TED in 2010 blew us all away. But even more astounding to me was that they had learned many of their skills by watching YouTube. As their producer John Chu put it, "Dancers have created a whole global laboratory online for dance, where kids in Japan are taking moves from a YouTube video created in Detroit, building on it within days, and releasing a new video, while teenagers in California are taking the Japanese video and remixing it with a Philly flair to create a whole new dance style in itself. And this is happening every day. From these bedrooms and living rooms and garages, with cheap webcams, come the world's great dancers of tomorrow." YouTube had sparked a kind of global contest for dance innovation, causing the art form to evolve at breakneck speed. Chu had noticed this and had turned to YouTube as his main recruitment source for new dance talent. And the LXD was so breathtakingly good, they were chosen that year to perform at the Oscars. As I listened to Chu and watched the LXD in action, it hit me that the exact same phenomenon was happening in public speaking. Speakers were watching each other's talks online and learning from each other, seeking to copy what was good and then add their own unique innovations. In fact, you could see the same phenomenon at work in any skill that could be shared on video, from cake decorating to juggling. Online video was providing two things that had never before been available so potently. Visibility of the best talent in the world, a massive incentive to improve on what was out there. The incentive was simply the thrill of becoming a YouTube star. The prospect of all those views, likes, and comments can motivate someone to slave away for hours or weeks, perfecting their own skills to be videoed and uploaded. If you spend any time on YouTube, you can discover thousands of niche communities revolving around everything from unicycling to parkour to video poetry to Minecraft, teaching each other to do astonishing things. This phenomenon demanded a name. I began calling it crowd-accelerated innovation. And by far its most exciting application is in the world of ideas. For all of history, the vast majority of all talks given before an audience have remained invisible to all but those who were actually there. Today, for the first time, it's possible to go online and see thousands of different speakers in action on almost any topic you care to name. It's possible to see how well their talks are regarded by looking at view counts, comments, etc., and therefore to filter down to the ones you most want to see. So suddenly we have an amazing laboratory at our disposal. And we also have a fantastic new incentive for millions of people to participate in this laboratory. If your best opportunity to give a talk is just for a few colleagues or at a local club, you might not be that incentivized to really prepare. But now that what you say can be recorded and put online, that's different. Your potential audience is in the millions. Well, now how much time are you willing to put in? This is a recipe for a glorious upward spiral of learning, innovation, sharing, and more learning. That's why I believe today's talk renaissance is only just getting underway. At TED, we've sought to nurture it in three main ways, in addition to sharing TED Talks on our site. 1. A TEDx event near you. In 2009, we began offering a free license to people who wanted to organize a TED-like event in their own town or city. We used the label TEDx, where X means it is independently organized and also signifies the multiplier effect of this program. To our delight, thousands of people have organized TEDx events. More than 2,500 are held every year in more than 150 countries. They have led to more than 60,000 TEDx talks being uploaded to YouTube, and a growing number of those talks have gone viral. If you don't think you can give the talk you want to give at work, you could consider reaching out to your local TEDx organizer. There might be the perfect stage waiting in your own neighborhood. 2. A kids program for presentation literacy. We launched a free program for schools called TED-Ed Clubs that allows any teacher to offer a group of kids a chance to give their own TED Talk. A session once a week for 13 weeks encourages selection of an idea, tips on how to research it, and then the skills to prepare and deliver the talk. The boost to the confidence and self-esteem of kids who make it through to the delivered talk is inspiring to see. We think presentation literacy should be a core part of every school's curriculum, on par with reading and math. It's going to be an important life skill to have in the decades ahead. 3. Upload your own TED Talk. We have a program called Open TED that allows anyone to upload their own TED-like talk to a special section on our site. We specifically encourage innovation, not just in content, but in how the talk is given. We're betting someone out there will hit on a beautiful new way to share ideas. Perhaps it will be you. And over the next decade, as several billion more people get online, we're excited at the prospect of reaching out to them and offering a means to learn from the great teachers who can empower them to achieve a better life, and to share their unique insights and ideas with the rest of us. The prospect of a world population growing to 10 billion over the coming 30 years is daunting, but it's a lot less so if you imagine that it will bring not just more consumption, but also more wisdom. The revolution in public speaking is something everyone can be part of. If we can find a way to truly listen to each other and learn from each other, the future glitters with promise. 21. Your turn. The philosopher's secret. My father was a missionary eye doctor. He devoted his life to trying to cure blindness in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Somalia, while simultaneously trying to spread the Christian gospel. It's probably a good thing he never got to see one of the first speakers I brought to the TED stage. That was philosopher Dan Dennett, an avowed atheist. They would have disagreed pretty much across the board, except on one thing. Halfway through a riveting talk on the power of memes, Dennett said this: "The secret of happiness is find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it." That is a statement my father would have profoundly agreed with. Dennett is a passionate advocate for the power of ideas. He was highlighting an extraordinary fact about humans, one that's unique to our species. We are sometimes willing to subjugate our biological needs for the pursuit of ideas that matter. And in Dennett's view, and my father's, and mine, that pursuit is one of the keys to a meaningful, satisfying life. We're strange creatures, we humans. At one level, we just want to eat, drink, play, and acquire more stuff. But life on the hedonic treadmill is ultimately dissatisfying. A beautiful remedy is to hop off it and instead begin pursuing an idea that's bigger than you are. Now, in your case, I of course don't know what that idea is. And maybe, right now, you don't know either. Maybe you want to highlight an invisible community in your town, or do some historical research into a family member whose courage should be better known, or organize cleanup days in your community, or delve into marine science, or get active in a political party, or build a new piece of technology, or travel somewhere where human needs are 100 times greater than anything you've faced, or just tap into the experience and wisdom of the people you meet. Whatever it is you pursue, if you truly go after it, I predict 2 things. Yes, you'll find a meaningful form of happiness. And you'll discover something that matters far more than any piece of advice you've read in this book. You'll discover something worth saying. And then what? Well, then of course you must share it, using all the passion, skills, and determination you can muster. Share it in the way that ultimately only you will know how to do. Start a fire that will spread new wisdom far and wide. Tom Chatfield is a technology commentator who spoke at one of our events. My colleague Bruno Giussani asked him for his advice for other speakers. This is what he said: "The most amazing thing about a talk, for me, is its potential for impact. The short talk you're about to give has the potential not only to reach hundreds of thousands of people, but to start many thousands of conversations. And so the central advice I would give is to push yourself as hard as possible to be bold and brave, to try to step outside the comfort zone of what you know for sure, or what others have said already, and to give the world questions and inspirations that deserve 1,000 conversations. It's not about being right or safe, it seems to me, so much as about having a staggering opportunity to create something that will breed further ideas." I love that quote. I want a future in which people realize their potential to nudge the world. Seeding a valuable idea, I am convinced, is the most impact that's possible for an individual to have. Because in a connected world, that idea, once properly seeded, is capable of spreading itself. There's no limit to the number of people it can influence, both now and in the future. But what about those who would nudge the world in a bad direction? Can't public speaking be used for harm as well as good? It can. From demagogues to soul-destroying cynics, there's plenty of painful evidence of this. However, I don't think there's complete symmetry here. There are strong reasons to believe that the accelerating growth of spoken content is going to tilt positive. Let me explain. As we've learned, to give an effective talk, a speaker has to go to where a listener is and say, come, let's build something together. The speaker must show why the idea is worth building. There is a reaching out, an appeal to shared values, desires, hopes, and dreams. In certain circumstances, this process can be terribly abused. A crowd can be whipped up, hatred inflamed. False views of the world can be propagated as real. But in history, this has always happened when, at least to some degree, listeners are shut off from the rest of the world. The appeal that is being made by the speaker is not universal. It is tribal. It is us versus them. And crucial facts are hidden from those listeners. But when we're more closely connected, when people have full visibility of the world and each other, something different starts to happen. Then the speakers who will have the most influence will be those who succeed in tapping into those values and dreams that are most widely shared. They will be those who use arguments based on facts that many people, not just a few, can see to be true. Imagine two religious speakers who want to influence the entire world. One of them speaks of the superiority of his own religion over all others and urges mass conversion. The other notices that the single deepest value of his religion, compassion, is also shared by every other religion. He decides he will speak on that, and he makes an effort to speak in universal terms that those from other religions will respond to and will be moved by. Which of those speakers has the bigger potential audience and long-term impact? Or imagine two global political leaders, one of whom appeals only to the interests of one race, while the other reaches out to all members of humanity. Which one garners more support in the end? If it were the case that humans were irredeemably xenophobic, close-minded, racist, then to be sure, the second politician would have no hope. But I don't believe that to be the case. I believe that what we share is far more meaningful, more profound than how we differ. We all hunger, yearn, suffer, laugh, weep, and love. We all bleed. We all dream. We are all capable of empathy, of putting ourselves in other shoes. And it is possible for visionary leaders, or anyone with the courage to stand up and say something, to tap into this shared humanity and to nurture it. I spoke earlier of the power of reason over the very long term. Reason, by its very nature, seeks to look at the world not from an individual perspective, but from the perspective of all of us. Reason rejects arguments that say, I want this to happen because it's in my interest, in favor of, here's why we should all want this to happen. If reason didn't do this, it could never have become the common currency of discussion that allows humans to align. When we say, be reasonable, this is exactly what we mean. We're saying, please, look at the issue from a broader perspective. The power of reason, combined with the growing connectedness of the world, tilts the balance of influence in favor of speakers who are willing to put themselves in the shoes of all of us, not just the other members of their own tribe. The latter may have their moments of power, but it is the former who will win in the end. That is why I deeply believe in Martin Luther King Jr.'s shining statement, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. There really is an arrow to history. There really is such a thing as moral progress. If we pull the camera back for a moment, away from whatever evil du jour is dominating the news, we can see that progress writ large in the history of the last few centuries, not least in the impact of MLK himself. And it has every chance of continuing. As humans continue to be brought closer, not just by technology, but by an ever deeper understanding of each other, so we will find more ways of seeing in each other the things we mutually care about. And that is how barriers come down and human souls unite. It won't happen quickly, nor easily. This type of change is multi-generational, and there are plenty of imaginable disasters that could blow it off course. But at least we have a shot. Talking with each other is a crucial part of nurturing that change. We're wired to respond to each other's vulnerability, honesty, and passion, provided we just get a chance to see it. Today, we have that chance. In the end, It's quite simple. We are physically connected to each other like never before, which means that our ability to share our best ideas with each other matters more than it ever has. The single greatest lesson I have learned from listening to TED Talks is this. The future is not yet written. We are all collectively in the process of writing it. There's an open page and an empty stage waiting for your contribution.
We hope you've enjoyed our presentation of TED Talks, the official TED Guide to Public Speaking by Chris Anderson. Performed by Chris Anderson, Tom Riley, and Kelly Stetzel. Directed by Lewis Milgram. Performance copyright 2016 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.